right, good evening, everybody. It's Bill Blackman, Carter Kirshire. We are the Yanks Coming Soccer Show, welcoming you in for another evening. Tonight we're going to talk about the USWFTCDA. The deal finally gets done, and it gets done prior to the beginning of the NWSL season. We will also talk about the 2026 CONCACAF joint bid. And then we'll discuss a little bit of some Yanks abroad news. I know we promised this show would be an MLS show. We haven't forgotten about MLS. Trust us. We just stuff happens.
We just get overtaken by events every week. Apologies to MLS fans. Your time is coming.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's definitely, I mean, look, so early in the year. We'll get to it. But let's start with the women's CDA. Karnick, kind of your just broad overview thoughts on U.S. soccer and the women getting a deal done.
Well, I certainly think it's an improvement for the women. It's not everything that everybody wanted on the player side, I can tell you that. I can also tell you that there's a little more angst among Tier 2, Tier 3 players that are not necessarily subsidized national team players in NWSL that are making the NWSL salary, which, by the way, there's been a salary bump in NWSL this year. I don't know if everybody is aware of that, but the base salary now is $15,000, which is a substantial increase, and can go upwards to about, I believe, $52,000. So, relatively speaking, compared to what we've gone through in NWSL the first few seasons, what we went through at the end of WPS, good numbers. So that's good for those Tier 2, Tier 3, Tier 4 players. But I think that there's some concern for them that they're not subsidized players, so they're making somewhere in that NWSL salary range, and they're not necessarily going to make a whole lot more money in national team duty than they are now. Now, for the Tier 1 players, this is a big victory. This is a recognition of the power of the women's game, the marketability of those top 15 or 20 players. Those are players whose salaries are, of course, in NWSL. Well, the ones that play in NWSL, there are a few that don't now. But the ones that do play in NWSL, their salaries are carried by the U.S. Soccer Federation. I think it is a big victory for them. I think they're very happy with it. I think, in general, people are happy with it. I just mentioned that the other players, the rank and file players, because they're the ones who are always kind of not talked about when we're talking about CBA agreements, whether it's this CBA, whether it's the U.S. men's national team, or most controversially, the last few go-arounds, the MLS CBA. But I think all in all, a good deal, and props to everybody for getting it done. Although it didn't necessarily have to be this painful, and maybe that's something we'll get into later in the show.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a vindication of the women's strategy. Particularly the wage complaint, I think, was just an effective reminder to U.S. soccer that, you know, the women were going to be very furious and that their demands needed to be taken seriously. I also thought that the change in sort of the leadership structure after the Olympics, where it became Becca Rue took over and Becky Sauerbrunn and Kristen Prem kind of went to the forefront of that group along with Megan Klingenberg. And I thought that change probably facilitated and ushered in the deal. The most important part of the deal that you didn't mention, because I think you mentioned, you know, the stuff that I would have brought up, was I think that the marketing of likeness and sponsorship rights, I think that provides a lot of income flexibility across the board, where women previously kind of had to kowtow to whatever U.S. soccer sponsorships were. That's a really big improvement and not an insignificant one. And I think so that's really good for the Tier 2 and Tier 3 U.S. players as well. But I also think that some of the more baseline improvements and commitments that they got U.S. soccer to make to NWSL, whether it be just simple stadium improvements or requirements, requirements, grass fields, if you will. That kind of stuff is overlooked now, maybe because we don't know how it'll work. But I think they can be very proud of the work that they did to get that deal. And like you said, from a U.S. soccer perspective, U.S. soccer could be particularly pleased with the way things broke out, too, especially the optics of getting it done before the NWSL season starts are pretty good for U.S. soccer at a time where, you know, until the U.S. beat Honduras, Dudo Gulati and the entire federation were kind of under a lot of pressure. And there hadn't been a lot of victories for U.S. soccer. This, I think, could arguably be claimed as one.
Right, there's still, and I think we talked about this, the D2 situation on a previous show, the NASL versus USL situation. I think Sunil Gulati, as I reflect on that with some perspective, probably played that about as well as he could, although it was a result that I think left fans of both leagues scratching their head and left a lot of people in both leagues, particularly USL, scratching their head. It was a consensus-oriented approach that got us where we got, but it took 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks, which were had a tremendous effect on the marketing of the clubs during the offseason. I think in this case, similarly, a consensus-based approach, I think there is going to be some increased money that flows into the women's game because of the CBA, and that helps those Tier 2 and Tier 3 players. That helps those long-term Tier 1 players for the United States. The next group coming through, we already see Jill Ellis really kind of freshening up her squad, the Russia friendlies these last 2 weeks, and the She Believes Cup. So a lot of changes afoot. I think for me, significantly, I think it's important to kind of look at how U.S. soccer perceives the importance of the women's game. There was a feeling among a lot of people around the women's game that it was a train and a horse U.S. soccer rode to a certain point until the men's game became more popular in this country and there was a significant revenue from men's national team and MLS / some related entities. And this feeling that U.S. soccer had gotten to where it had gotten in the late 90s and early 2000s, taking out the fact that they hosted the 1994 World Cup, the Men's World Cup, largely through the women's game, and that was no longer being appreciated. I think that now is no longer so much of a talking point because the Federation made the right move towards progressing the women's game at a time, and we've talked about this over and over again, Neil, at a time when the big men's powerhouse nations of Western Europe, who didn't take the women's game very seriously until recently now, are deadly serious about it. England, Germany, France, in particular, and we saw those three in the She Believes Cup last month, and those three countries have been able to piggyback off the popularity of their men's leagues, and particularly England, because England has the most popular men's league in the world, most popular sports league in the world, in the Premier League, been able to piggyback off the success of certain clubs and basically force clubs to lose money on the women's game to develop the infrastructure for the women's game in those countries that, quite frankly, as much as Major League Soccer has done in the last 20 years and as much progress as they've made, with the exception of Portland and Orlando, the two teams you see, obviously Houston is attached also, but Portland and Orlando and North Carolina is attached to an NASL team. The kind of infrastructure that MLS teams cannot provide to their women's sister teams. So that's a challenge, and we had to upgrade where we were and how our players were feeling about the system and the commitment level from U.S. soccer and people around the game were feeling in order to compete with that, quite honestly. And
no, I agree. And I think that's why those infrastructural commitments are really important, and I also think that's why incentivizing USWNT call-up bonuses, improving what the bonuses were to non-contract players, improving per diem, which a lot of the players that aren't Tier 1 players are just pocketing their per diem because here's a way to make money. You know, little things like that are they may seem like small improvements under the CBA, but they do a nice job of spreading the wealth around in places where it either didn't exist or couldn't exist under the prior CBA.
Right. The kind of improvements that we've seen in Major League Soccer and subsequent CBAs. Now MLS, look, I know there are a lot of new fans that became MLS fans when we know a lot of people in our neck of the woods, in Orlando, that became MLS fans 2 years ago when Orlando City moved to MLS from USL, or when Portland fans, etc. So they don't know necessarily the history of the CBAs and the Players Union and the Frazier lawsuit and all of this stuff in Major League Soccer. But I think you're seeing a progression that's eerily similar to that. Not, it's not eerie, because it ultimately it's getting done in the right way for the players, but that the taking the steps and being able to effectively get concessions out of the governing body, whether it's U.S. Soccer in this case or Major League Soccer in the case of those men's players, has been something that has required a certain degree of media savvy and press strategy from player agents and from the players themselves. If Carly Lloyd and Alex Morgan and Hope Solo, et cetera, don't take this fight on publicly, they don't get this CBA. It's as simple as that. I know the CBA has fallen short for a lot of people, and I talked about this in the beginning, maybe the expectation and the bar that those players set. But if they don't set the bar where they do, the CBA ends up like the last CBA, which was kind of a tacit admission or just kind of a continuation of the previous CBA without any of these improvements that the players have needed, quite frankly, for 5 years now.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, and maybe it's just the lawyer in me, that was what was so brilliant about the wage complaint. It wasn't necessarily that they were ever going to go through with the wage complaint, although they probably would have weathered the stage to where the EEOC would have said, hey, you have a claim. It was the ruckus that it stirred up, right? I mean, a lot of the time, that's sort of the point of pre-suit litigation stuff, is, hey, let's create enough of a ruckus to where if we go to mediation, if we go to arbitration, if we're at a bargaining table, there's an uproar. And so what U.S. Soccer did at that table mattered a lot more. And remember that this is all stuff that they initiated and or threatened to initiate prior to winning the World Cup or just after winning the World Cup, right? So, I mean, these are this external pressure that they placed on U.S. Soccer that got so much public attention was a product of a long-term strategy to attract attention to disparities, to per diem disparities, to hotel accommodation disparities, to the fact that they had no control over their likenesses under the prior CBA. All this stuff wasn't necessarily designed to get a lawsuit, but it was designed to say, hey, people are watching you, U.S. Soccer, and you can throw a bunch of she believes cups and make arguments about how, and true, but that doesn't mean you can rest on your laurels, that this march of progress continues. And, U.S. soccer has to be reactionary to that progress. It's no different than arguments we make about tactics. In that respect, the best countries in the world have to respond to the tactical changes in the game to remain the best countries in the world. Well, U.S. soccer, from that standpoint, had to respond to what was happening around them, and that external pressure kind of was a kick in the behind, in my opinion.
Right, I agree, and I think that there's also a recognition by U.S. soccer that they had external pressures coming from the players, and they had external pressures coming from Europe, and it was really brought front and center and pronounced in a way that maybe it couldn't have been otherwise after that France game, the England game, the France game last month. And I think at that point, even though they'll never admit it, they realized, okay, we're now not competing at as high a level as we were. Maybe we have to incentivize our women to do better and reward them for getting us to this point. So I think that this sounds really kind of odd, and it's not a conspiracy theory at all, because I don't think they went out with the intent to lose, obviously, but that losing those two matches, I think, may have made this easier for them, believe it or not. Because it put a front and center the need to get this solved and get back to competing with those countries.
Yeah, I mean, I think Gulati's an economist, right? So there right. was coupling the Olympics loss with, which wasn't a loss, they didn't lose, they lost the penalties.
Yeah, I think this was more striking. The France game was striking because it was just
sure.
so one-sided.
But if you combine Olympic failure with France at the She Believes Cup.
Right.
So there was obviously starting to be, and I think the media deserves some credit as well. There was starting to be an opportunity cost to being recalcitrant, to not, meeting some of the demands that the U.S. women were putting forward, and the fact that they hadn't withdrawn their wage complaint. Those types of things really helped, I think, get the deal done. But I do think, at the end of the day, it's really important that it was done prior to the beginning of the women's season. I just think that, to not have that season begin under that kind of murky cloud is a good thing. Like, instead, we can talk about Amarta signing with Orlando. We can talk about players and personnel moves, and we should probably get either Jeff Kasufer or Richard Farley on here to do some of that for us.
Yeah, but I actually want to ask you about Marta signing with Orlando City, and perhaps it's because I do have to write an article about it in the next 48 hours. But I just want to kind of get your take on it, because obviously there was a long courtship. But I think, and there's Brazilian ownership in Orlando, but I think it's a sign that NWSL isn't necessarily on the wane. It's still attractive to high-end foreign players. Yes, a lot of them have now gone to the Leones, like Alex Morgan, where Alex Morgan's playing now, the Chelseas, the Man Cities, etc. But there is still a brand for NWSL and for women's professional soccer in the United States. That transcends just U.S. national team players and U.S. college players.
Yeah, I mean, I would add that Becky Sauerbrunn, who is the best defender in the world and could play anywhere she wants, re-signed as well. So
correct. Yeah, that's significant.
I think that's a little bit of a distinction between, because I understand your point that it's not just about, but you have an international star like Sauerbrunn. Whether or not she's a marketing star is a different question. But the point being, I agree with your point that from a technical perspective, that's really good. I think from a U.S. women's national team perspective, Marta being in Orlando is enormous. I think that there are things about Alex Morgan's soccer game that there are still things that she's learning and figuring out. I mean, we forget how young she is. And I think playing with Marta is really an immense opportunity for her. For one, I think it gives her sort of the cover to not be the isolated superstar that, recent USWNT games have proven that she's not. But I also think that there are leadership things that she can learn as well. And, U.S. leadership is going to be different whenever Carly Lloyd phases out. Becky Sauerbrunn will be old enough at the 2019 World Cup to where it's reasonable to think her soccer might have slipped a little bit. I don't know if it will. Certainly she takes incredible care of herself and is technically a brilliant player. But, I think the U.S., there are some questions in terms of a leadership vacuum and some things that Alex Morgan can pick up from playing for Tom Sermonti and playing with Marta that are really good. And obviously, I think from an Orlando's perspective, that's an attractive signing. I mean, there aren't many young girls that play the game that don't know who Marta is. It's a draw.
Right. Even if, as Abby Wambach reminded us, Sepp Blatter didn't seem to know who she was, who Marta was a couple years ago. Yeah, I mean, I had forgotten about that. And Abby was on television not long ago and had mentioned this, that this was, again, another, to her, insult to the women's game by FIFA was... And I don't remember the incident specifically, but apparently there was one at the Ballon d'Or ceremony where Blatter clearly didn't know who Marta was and hadn't watched her and that sort of thing. But yeah, there are very few people who don't know who she is. And I think that this is a marquee signing for the league. It also gives the league an opportunity to once again market teams when she goes away from home. And Orlando will be the first team Marta's played for in this country if I'm thinking correctly, that actually stays in business long-term, because L.A., the Bay Area team, I forget what they were called in WPS, and then obviously she went to Western New York and was successful, but that team now has relocated to Carolina after a long period of success. And obviously they're the reigning champions. So, I know... I talk to Neil Morris quite often about the Courage, and there is a lot of excitement there about the club. Paul Riley, they've been able to retain as the head coach. There was some concern about that when the club was relocated, but Steve Malik and Kurt Johnson got that deal done. But there's still a little bit of kind of residual, well, will this team perform at the same level after a relocation? I mean, it's just very, very awkward thing. But maybe we'll get to that as the NWSL season, after we have a couple weeks in the books. I do want to remind our listeners that you can watch the season, the NWSL, every week this year on A&E. So significant television partner for women's soccer in this country. Yeah, similar package, similar investment to what Turner Sports had in the old WUSA. Turner Sports.
Right.
Owned about 20% of the league, and it invested in specific clubs, and A&E is doing the same. But let's transition, Neil, real quickly. Let's take a look at Yanks Abroad. We were hoping to have a Pulisic update tonight. We're recording this on Tuesday night, and probably by the time you listen to this, he would have played. You will know how he performed in the Champions League, but some scary events today in Dortmund.
Yeah, I mean, just horrifying stuff. And I'm glad to hear that the injury suffered is not, career threatening from what I understand. Certainly I think everybody saw a Dortmund player injured in bomb blast, and I'm sure there are plenty of Americans thinking kind of selfishly, oh my gosh, please tell me that Christian Pulisic wasn't injured in a freak bomb blast. But yeah, I mean, certainly thoughts with the player and glad that the injury is not too serious. I don't know. I mean, what can you even say about these sorts of things, especially when they happen before a Champions League match? Certain things that you think are just sacred and off limits, and that's just not the world anymore.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the case. John Brooks had a nice goal this weekend on a header for Hertha Berlin. They're chasing a European spot. They're not going to make it to the Champions League. The top four in Germany have which are Bayern, Leipzig, Hoffenheim, and Dortmund, have separated themselves from the rest of the league. But Hertha Berlin in contention for a Europa League spot. So good news on that front. And I thought a pretty solid game for Jeff Cameron against Liverpool.
Yeah.
The first half, I thought he was really good. A couple of problems for Stoke in the second half. But I thought Cameron played pretty well in that game. And that game obviously was on national television.
Yeah, it was a marvelous game. Really a wonderful advert for the league. Not that that league needs them. But just a fantastic game, especially tactically. I thought that the 4-4-2 that Stoke played, where you had the second forward almost behind the wingers, would be a really interesting experiment for Bruce Arena, actually. I had these visions of Josie Altidore or Bobby Wood tucking in behind Christian Pulisic or Fabian Johnson, in a 4-4-2, sort of like the one that Stoke had deployed. And, you know, I think that would work for the Americans. It was really fascinating game. But Jeff did play pretty well. Bobby Wood played this weekend as well.
And he had a fantastic assist that won the game for Hamburg. A critical game. They're beginning to pull away from the relegation zone. They're 4 points clear, I believe, now. So, once again, Hamburg, which back when Benny Feilhaber played for them, was a big, big club making Champions League regularly. Now they're fighting relegation every year. But Bobby Wood, I'm impressed because it's difficult if you're an American. Look, I mean, we talk about this, about settling and playing regularly for a club in general. A mid-table club or a club that's contending for Europe or European place. I tell you, it's more difficult as an American who's never played in a top-flight league like Bobby Wood, even though he's played in Germany for a number of years, to go to a club that's fighting relegation and you're an attacking player and you have to either create goals or score goals. And he's done it, and he stayed in that team for the bulk of the season, except when he's been injured. We saw what happened to Jozy Altidore when he went to Sunderland and they were fighting relegation. That was the end of him there. You can't, when you're in that position, you have a two or three bad games in a row, you're out. So I'm so impressed by Bobby Wood.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I tweeted out this week, I don't know if it was this week or last week, but I mentioned that I feel like Kieran Klinsmann, and again, this gets back to just, you know, the sort of defensive Klinsmann as technical director, not as manager. But he does deserve a lot of credit for the number of Americans that have succeeded in the Bundesliga. And I do include Pulisic in that category. I certainly imagine that Klinsmann encouraged Pulisic to try to stick at that club. I admire the fact that Julian Green has tried to stay and stick. He's probably kind of the exception, but Bobby Wood, Timmy Chandler certainly could have been very easy for Chandler to try to go elsewhere and leave like Danny Williams did. He did not do that. He's rewarded U.S. soccer with maybe the best performance of an American in the Bundesliga, save Pulisic this season. You could probably argue that he's been better than Pulisic from a consistency standpoint.
Right, yeah.
So I think a lot of credit for that, but Bobby Wood has been really vocal about saying, look, you know, after I hurt my knee, Jurgen Klinsmann kind of saved my career. It's not just that he told me, hey, it's okay to play in the lower divisions in Germany. It's that here was a guy who had a lot of talent and had a really atrocious knee injury. And it's kind of fun to think of where Bobby Wood would be without that injury now, but it's also a testament to sort of Klinsmann's ability to motivate that he was able to say, hey, you know, it's okay. This isn't the end of the world for you. You're 20 years old. You know, prove that you're worth it at this level. And everything with Klinsmann is just a challenge of proving your worth. And I think that's kind of what you want a technical director to do.
Yeah, exactly. Not the head coach.
US soccer, yeah, I mean, it's made U.S. soccer better, I think. To have this number of players playing in that league. And as you and I have discussed plenty of times, I mean, that's an exceptional league, and it's a league
I think from a quality standpoint, it's as good as England, if not slightly better. Eric Ronaldo makes that case regularly, that he thinks the Bundesliga is a more technical league. It may not have quite the frantic pace of England and the quality on the attacking end, but the kind of the subtleties of the game and defensive and tactical shape, it's a better league in his opinion. One last note, you know, I have to bring this up. David Wagner, of course, former U.S. men's national team player, chasing promotion as manager of Huddersfield Town, ran into Nottingham Forest this week, and Eric Lehigh went 90 minutes in a stunning 2-0 Forest win, which puts Huddersfield's chances for automatic promotion in serious jeopardy. They're now, I believe, 8 points behind Brighton. They have a game in hand, but they could have closed to within five, and really two if they had won that game in hand. Have they beaten Forest? And that gets Forest a little further away from the relegation zone. But Lehigh goes 90 minutes in a big game with a lot on the line. One team chasing promotion, the other team fighting relegation. So Bruce Arena has mentioned him a few times, hoping we see him in June.
many times by the Eric Lehigh mention from the national team manager right. that I still have PTSD, I think.
Yeah, but I think this time Arena means it. I think he's monitoring closely.
I'm sure. Well, I'm not sure of anything, but I hope that he does mean it. He's certainly a professional, a consummate professional, Eric Lehigh, and really the only indispensable American footballer in England right now.
Yeah, right. No, that's true. We've talked about that before. So let's transition here to talk a little bit about the World Cup bid, which I think has been controversial. I don't think it's controversial at all in the United States and in Canada. And for Canada, it's a gift. And perhaps this is something that you're going to have some folks like folks in Panama and Honduras and Costa Rica unhappy about, because they get CONCACAF up to 6.5 spots with the 48-team World Cup. And now that the U.S. and Mexico are going to qualify anyway, right? But now that you've got Canada, you're essentially losing a spot. There will be a spot that's taken away from a CONCACAF country that probably would have qualified through the normal process. Canada, based on their recent history, not only would not qualify for a World Cup, they wouldn't even make it to the final round of qualifying, right? The hexagonal last minute to the hex in 1997, for those who are unaware of their recent history. But
aren't you excited to see Kyle Larin play in a World Cup, though, Karnick?
Yeah, and a couple of guys. I mean, I think that there were a number of Canadian players. Unfortunately, arguably the greatest player of all time, Dwayne D. Rosario, is not going to get that opportunity. But there are guys that are playing right now in Europe, a number of good Canadian players. Maybe Atiba Hutchinson can keep going until 2026 to get... I don't know that he has 9 more years in his career. Probably not. But guys like that and Rob Friend, there are a number of really good Canadian players. And there were the previous generation, Paul Sauteri, I think about, and Julian de Guzman, and so many guys. And you think about if they had gotten Juan de Guzman to play for them and Asmir Begovic to play for them, and there are one or two others that are escaping me now that they lost out on, that maybe they would have had better fortunes. But the point I was going to make, Neil, and throw it over to you, is there is a lot of angst about this south of the border, that instead of launching an independent bid, they have settled for 10 games, most of which will be group stage games in a 48-team World Cup, and no semifinals or the final, potentially at Azteca. This having been said, I have to say this is a masterful political stroke by Sunil Gulati in U.S. soccer to take the potential competition off the table. Mexico, I guess, decided it would be better to get a piece of it than to lose out completely.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a master stroke by Sunil. Give credit where credit's due. I have to say, and maybe there will be a knockout match at Cruz Azul or someplace of that ilk. It's disappointing that a semifinal, according to at least what Gulati has said, would not be at Azteca. You know, a place that's had a World Cup final. And certainly one of the most storied buildings in the sport.
It may just be coincidence, but people still talk today about the 1970 and 1986 World Cups as being two of the best World Cups they've ever seen, if not the two best they've ever seen. I mean, I would put, for me, maybe, and it's not just because the U.S. did well, but for me, I put 2002 up there, other than the fact that there was the horrible time difference that we had to deal with. But the upsets, the level of play, I thought was really high in that World Cup. But you hear from people that had been around the game and are older than us, Neil, that 70 and 86 were the two best World Cups they've seen, and they were both in Mexico.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised. It's a wonderful country. It's certainly one of my favorite places that I've been. Very welcoming place. Plenty of really fascinating and actually kind of scenic football stadiums. I mean, in America, we have Philadelphia, where it's kind of picturesque. We have, in its own special way. And then we have Salt Lake, certainly the Rose Bowl, is a magnificent place to watch any sporting event. Orlando City, I haven't been there yet, but from what I understand, you know, this is a beautiful place that can certainly host a group stage match. But it's weird to think about, you know, a place like Glendale, for example, getting a semifinal, and that will be the compromise, I'm sure, is that U.S. Soccer will say, hey, we'll go to Dallas, or we'll go to Arizona, or somewhere in the Southwest for one of the two semifinals, with the logic being that if Mexico advanced that far, that, you know, they would have the spoils that a host country gets. And then, you know, if the United States and Christian Pulisic advance to that round, they could play in New York or Chicago or somewhere of that ilk. But I think it would be a little bit disappointing, honestly, if Azteca weren't a place to host one of the last three games and excluding the third place match. And honestly, I wouldn't object to Vancouver or Montreal or Toronto hosting a semifinal as well. I mean, if you're going to have a three-country World Cup, then let the three countries host.
I think for Canada, it's a dicey situation. You know, we have a problem in the United States. We always talk about hosting games against certain countries and certain locales. For Canada, I've talked to so many Canadians about this. If you play anybody in Toronto, chances are they're going to have as many fans as you, particularly in a World Cup type of quality. Sure. You play Croatia in Toronto, or you play Jamaica, or you play someone like that, they're going to have more fans. And it actually happened, I think, in a qualifier against Jamaica a few cycles ago, and it was one of those qualifying rounds where Jamaica advanced, and they got to the hex, and Canada was eliminated. They played Jamaica at BMO, and there were more Jamaican fans, or more, maybe not more Jamaican fans, but they were more vocal. So for Canada, I think they might go towards Edmonton, where they sent the U.S. women's team last year. Maybe Vancouver,
right.
But I'm thinking Toronto might be one they want to avoid putting Canada at. Now, I'm sure Toronto will host games. It's the most cosmopolitan city on this side of the this hemisphere, in the Western Hemisphere. So I think they have to host games. I just don't know if Canada is going to want to be in Toronto.
Yeah, somebody asked me, and I'm interested in your take on this, so we can kind of close with this little fun hypothetical. But, you know, somebody asked me when the bid came out. I got a text message, and it was just, hey, what three cities would you say the U.S. should play in if they're hosting group stage World Cup matches? And I immediately kind of said I had to think about it because we have so many good soccer cities now. But the three I came up with, I'm really interested in your take. I know I put you on the spot, you know, like zero time to prepare. But my answer was Salt Lake, Kansas City, and Atlanta. Maybe not Salt Lake, just because you could, or not Atlanta, because you want to limit the amount that the U.S. has to travel. And that would be a pretty long distance, unless it was that order, ABC, and then it wouldn't be quite as bad. But those are the three I would choose, I think, because I think you'd be far less at risk for playing a road game.
Yeah, I think Salt Lake is definitely on my list. Kansas City is a good one. Salt Lake, the only issue with is altitude, and the U.S. would have to get acclimated to that, but it gives you an advantage. So that would be one. Atlanta, boy, that's Atlanta is such an international city, but it's a soccer rabid city, and particularly when you get into the eastern suburbs, into DeKalb County, the eastern part of Fulton. And we're seeing it. I mean, I used to have to make these justifications about Atlanta. I don't have to anymore. I think people are now finally coming around on this. I had a conversation with someone today about, hey, you know, you told me about Atlanta a couple of years ago, and because this person I would work with at the NASL and tell me how bad Atlanta was as a market, which it was. It was terrible for the NASL, but I say, hey, there's a soccer community that will embrace an MLS team. If the MLS team is done right, it embraces an international image, goes out and gets a high-profile coach, some high-profile players, which, of course, they've done. Atlanta, so, that would be potentially number three, or you go to a place like, depending on whether you have a team there yet, at that point, a top flight team, obviously have a D2 team there. I think a place like Raleigh-Durham would be a good shout. Maybe Philly, obviously not New York, no Washington, no Boston, no Chicago. But that, if you want to get to the East Coast, maybe Raleigh-Durham or you do Atlanta. Obviously, you stay out of Florida. No question, probably Orlando and Miami will get games, but they'll be... Brazil will be playing in Orlando, and Miami could have their pick of country from Latin America or Italy. Italy or Spain would be quite at home in Miami.
Yeah. No, I think that there would probably be two Florida cities as well.
Yeah, and there were going to be. Remember, when we put in the bid for 2022, at the time Orlando hadn't caught on, right? It was going to be Tampa and Miami, and they were two of the finalists.
Since you brought it up, because they've been so impressive, and I'll defend the crowd, the 23,000 in the Trinidad match last September, which was on an odd Tuesday after Labor Day. But Jacksonville wouldn't be the worst group since Shell.
Well, remember, Jacksonville had made the cut to 27 last time, which was surprising to a lot of people. And I was kind of pumped about that, but knew that they wouldn't make the final cut. And if you remember, Sunil gave an explanation for why Chicago didn't make the final cut. And again, at the time, we thought it was definitive because we were going to get the World Cup in 2022, and the stadiums had been chosen. Right, yeah. And it was a stunner. Well, Chicago is not going to be hosting World Cup games, but Indianapolis is. And that was a stunner to us at the time. Now, in hindsight, Sunil was on to something because Indy, and I can attest to this as having been the PR director for NASL when we brought Indy 11 into that league. Indy is a great market for soccer. I didn't realize it in 2010 when Gulati had to justify to all of us in the media why Indy was picked over Chicago, but he got that one right.
Yeah, I mean, I talked to Michael Cameron about Jacksonville and, you know, his comment after only 22,000 showed up for the Trinidad qualifier was, well, it was a Tuesday after Labor Day. That's kind of brutal. That's a brutal ask.
Yeah.
For a lot of people. Because it's a 3-day weekend and you extend it and, you know, then you got work and stuff like that. But they still had 22,000. They had 52,000 for a friendly against Scotland there. So selling international soccer in Jacksonville is not particularly difficult. You have a lot of military. It's just kind of a patriotic place. And I can't even imagine the atmosphere in a city like that for a World Cup group stage match.
Yeah, it would be a big, big deal in the town. I mean, it would be a big deal anywhere. But I think it would be, you would get the kind of buy-in from sports media in Jacksonville that you may not in Miami or that you may not in Tampa and you will not in Miami. In Miami, right. Miami, Fort Lauderdale market, there are still a number of people who are card-carrying members of the soccer-hating industry that are in the media here. And you and I can speak to that from dealing with it. And it's like that in New York. It's like that in Boston. It's like that in Chicago.
Right.
For some reason, it's not like that. You know, we have this image that, oh, well, soccer is a very urban and cosmopolitan sport, which it is. And I think that that's where the fans tend to gravitate to those types of places, kind of a hipster place like Portland, a more liberal, emerging liberal place like Orlando, which is, for me, the most liberal city, not the most liberal area politically in the state. That would be Fort Lauderdale area, but the most liberal city itself is Orlando. But what we found is, like, these big cities, there are established, because there's a media hierarchy, and you eventually make it to New York, or you make it to L.A., or you make it to Miami. And there's an inherited hostility towards soccer with a lot of the sports writers in these big markets, which I think has also hurt MLS in those markets.
Right.
I think, look, I mean, I saw it in Washington, D.C. I spent plenty of time with my political work in that city, and I saw it firsthand when D.C. United was trying to get a stadium and the Washington Nationals moved to town, the kind of hostility that they were getting, that even though stadiums and public money for stadiums were shot down in other places for MLS teams, it was a little different. And
right.
That's an attraction, getting just tying a knot on this. That's an attraction of a place like Jacksonville. I mean, even guys who don't understand soccer who are in the media have embraced it when it's been in front of them. And You could have a similar friendly against Scotland at Joe Robbie Stadium, and no one in the local media in Miami who isn't connected to beIN Sport or to Univision or to us, and Christopher Harris of World Soccer Talk, would be covering it. You would not get your local affiliates, their top news anchors there. Now, in Jacksonville, they all went to that game against Scotland. I wasn't there for the Nigeria game, but I think they might have gone to that. I was in Miami that day.
Well, that was the send-off series game.
Yeah,
tell you firsthand.
And I know
that was an even bigger deal.
Yeah, and the Trinidad game I was talking about with a member of the Jacksonville Armada staff, and you know, he was just saying, "Hey, I wish we could get these guys to cover us," but that they got the kind of coverage the Jaguars did that night, even though you said there were only 22,000 in the stadium. So you have to think about places like that if you're Sunil Gulati in U.S. soccer, because you're going to get kind of critical mass in terms of media.
Sure. And, I mean, a place like Kansas City is a no-brainer, but it's where you put – and Salt Lake, I think, is really a no-brainer. They're used to playing at the altitude. They play qualifiers there. I mean,
yeah.
And, you know, I almost think it's so weird because I think two of the U.S. cities for group stage matches are so obvious.
Yeah, I would have come up with those same two off the top of my head. I mean, when you said it, those were the first two that came to mind. And then you said those first two first. Then you said Atlanta, and I thought, oh, well, maybe not. Maybe we're not in full agreement. But, yeah, I think those two are very obvious. And I'll tell you what a valuable home field advantage Salt Lake provides. Remember, that stadium in Sandy opened right before the end of the 2008 MLS season. Right away, U.S. soccer had a qualifier there. The very next home qualifier, which was in the sub-hex round, and we had already qualified, we had already advanced. If I'm not mistaken, it might have been the first qualifier Jozy Altidore played in, was in Sandy.
Right.
Was at that stadium.
All right. Well, that's good. So, guys, we will do an MLS show, we promise.
Yeah.
That's the thing
days.
That's going to happen.
It will.
I don't know which. We'll get somebody on. It'll probably be Will Partridge or Sucker Eagle, Jason Davis. And we'll talk some MLS. But thanks for listening tonight.